Hello, my name is Gavin Jones and I am Global Advisor for Rare Diseases at Open Health. We are a healthcare communications, evidence and access agency, highly invested in supporting better outcomes in rare disease. This audio recording was captured at a World Orphan Congress last year, and we are sharing so the insight provided by the roundtable discussion can reach a wider audience. It's on the topic of improving transition for adolescents moving from paediatric to adult care. You'll hear some really impactful stories of patient experience and a focus on how mental health can be better supported at a time of transition. We hope you enjoy listening.
So welcome to our interactive roundtable session on better supporting adolescents living with rare disease. I encourage you all to make this as interactive and intimate as possible by turning on your webcam, speaking up when you want to contribute, and please do participate. Our moderator today is Gavin Jones. So he's the Director of Rare Diseases at Open Health, and he'll kickstart our discussion and introduce Nicole and Vanessa Martin as well, and their story and journey today too. So welcome and thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Wing. And thanks very much for everyone for joining this morning. So yeah, I'm Gavin Jones. I work for Open Health. We're a global medical patient and value communications agency, significant investment in better outcomes in rare disease and come with a lot of experience. But today we're here to hear from other people, and I'm delighted to be joined by many people from the patient community and from my organization and other organizations out there. Since starting working in rare disease around 15 years ago, I've recognized the constant challenge of the transition patients need to make between pediatric and adult services. I myself live with two teenage sons at the moment, so do recognize the constant challenge of and tensions between a child striving for their independence with associated risk taking and a parent's desire to maintain control. And this is without a rare disease, making it even more challenging. It's a constant challenge, but it's a topic that hasn't had a lot of airtime to date. So I'm delighted that we can have the conversation today, and I'm looking forward to hearing from lots of people out there around their experiences and their thoughts in how we can improve support for adolescent patients living with rare disease. To help this live beyond this conversation, we are going to have this roundtable discussion written up by Rare Revolution magazine, and it will appear in their next edition, which happens to be on the topic of patient transition. And if you're not already subscribed to Rare Revolution magazine, I would definitely recommend you do that. It's free, and they really are brilliant at amplifying the patient voice in rare disease. So please do subscribe. Like I said, I've got some experience of living with teenagers, but I'm delighted to be joined by Nicole and Vanessa Martin, who are representing the Childhood Tumor Trust. And why I'm so delighted that they have both joined is that they will bring a mum and daughter experience of what it's like living through adolescence with a rare disease. Because I think it's important that we recognize that it's not just the support of the patients, it's the support of families as well. So I'm delighted that we can bring both the perspectives from Nicole and Vanessa. As Wing said, it would be fantastic if we can hear from people in the audience. Please turn your cameras on if you so desire. Please shout up when you'd like to speak. If you want to put something in the chat, please do that, and we'll come to you. Wing is in the background as well to help me, because as a bloke, I am no good at multitasking. So if your comment is ignored for a while, please don't worry. We will get to it eventually. But to start, I thought we'd kick off really hearing from Nicole and Vanessa around their journey, because it has been an interesting and challenging one. And I'd like to come to Nicole first. and ask you just to tell us a bit more about yourself and what you're currently up to.
So hi, I'm Nicole. So I'm 23 years old, and I'm currently studying up in Manchester for a design and engineering degree. I have a dog with assistance dog, and I enjoy swimming.
Great stuff. And Nicole, you have neurofibromatosis type 1.
So it's, for me, it causes, I have tumours on my sciatic nerve from between my hip to below my knee, so it causes me quite a bit of pain and discomfort. So I have slight mobility issues, so I use a wheelchair for like day-to-day things. That's mainly the big issue from the physical side, but then I also have autism, ADHD tendencies, and dyslexia, so I have some of the learning difficulties associated with the condition.
Thanks, Nicole. And you mentioned there around learning difficulties. How has education been for you then?
It's been difficult. It's not been the easiest, I would say. I also definitely know I always like to take the long route, as we say. I've always been told by a lot of by some of my support workers that I need to walk before I can run, as I tend to want to do stuff that I can't just do just yet. But it's taken me a bit longer to get to uni. So I was in college 2 years longer. Then I went to do a foundation year in the university in Wales. Then I moved to Manchester, did 1 year of mechanical engineering, just couldn't do exams, so had to swap to a different course, but had to fight to get onto that course.
Yeah.
So it's I've always having to prove to the, well, any educational, any kind of sector, that I am able to do academic stuff. It just might take me longer or a different way round, which tends to be that I always take my own way, or always make it my own way, my own path is, but I get there.
Great stuff. No, that's absolutely brilliant. And you talked about previously around education and missing school from being in hospital. That must have been pretty isolating for you.
Yeah, so my illness didn't really take much of an effect on me until I was in secondary school, which is, for most people who are going into secondary school, you know, you're going into a teenager. It's a big deal anyway when you don't have a medical condition. But then on top of transitioning to just being a teenager, I had my medical condition, and it was quite isolated a lot of the times because I was constantly in and out of hospital.
Yeah.
So I missed a lot of education, missed a lot of the socialising with people. So it did have a bit of an impact on not just educational, but social side of things as well, going into going from children to adolescence.
Yeah. And when did you transition from paediatric care into adult services, and how was that experience?
So that was it was quite traumatic for me, as I had been in hospital for about 6 months in my local hospital in the children's ward, and that was just a horrible experience in itself. I had to go to London for more specialist care, and it was kind of just, I woke up in the children's ward, got a transport to the hospital, got a phone call going, oh yeah, you're coming to the adult ward, the adult side. And I was like, what? Because I thought I was going into Evelina, my children's hospital. I knew it well. And that was it. So it was literally just left one hospital and then told, yep, you're going into the adult one. I had no transition in it at all into the adult services. It was just literally like a pin drop. That was it. You're gone. And it was quite just traumatic to go to a side I'd never been to, never seen. I didn't know anything. So it wasn't very nice.
Wow. So there was no period of getting used to, or a handover with the physicians and meeting them all together?
Nothing. It was just like the pin drop, just literally that's it. You're put into the adult side and that was it. Nothing to help get me used to it at all.
Wow. Okay. And Vanessa, how was this period for you?
It was horrific. I mean, I remember that day so clearly because Nicole was focused. Nicole spent a lot of time at the Evelina over the last, 10 years she'd been in and out there. So she knew everyone. And we assumed we were going to the Evelina. And like she says, we got a call in the taxi, the transport taking us up there. We were about 10 minutes away from London saying, by the way, she's going to the adult gastro ward. And I thought, how do I tell her? I can't tell her this. And she guessed and she just had a complete meltdown. And it was like, I don't know what to do. And then the other thing is that I'm not allowed to stay on the ward. So in the children's hospital, I had a bed and I could stay with her. Going to the adult ward, it was like, well, you go and find a hotel and Nicole's got to stay here. So we went on this ward and of course, you know, there were a lot of elderly people on the ward and she was actually going to be put on the ward and she was just breaking down. And then as luck would have it, the matron came over and she said, oh, I've been waiting for you two. And then she looked at me and she went, I know you. I said, I know you too. And it was my bridesmaid that I hadn't seen since she was five. It was my ex-husband's side. And I explained the whole situation to her. So she got us a side room. She got me a mattress on the floor. But, you know, that was luck. That was just luck that happened because I thought, I don't know what to do. And it was like, well, it doesn't really matter. And I thought, yes, it does. And the other thing was that her consultant in the local hospital had said that he would look after her till she was 19. That's what he said, but that's not what he did. Even when they say things, it was like, because she'd been in hospital for 6 months and they didn't really know what to do, they just wanted to get rid of her, basically. That's how we felt. They just wanted to get rid of her to adult services and then it's got nothing more to do with them.
No, go on, Vanessa. Go on, you carry
There
on.
Was one girl, I don't know if Nicole remembers, she was on the children's ward. She was a friend of Nicole's. She came in for a lumbar puncture. She went and had it and she woke up in the adult ward. It's just across the board that care, it's just not good. It's not good.
And how did you try and influence care, Vanessa? And you know, I know eventually you did find some physicians that could support you. How did you go about doing that?
Hundreds of meetings. I mean, the local hospital, there was no support. Nobody listened. I didn't influence care at all. It was just literally trying to find somebody that would help. So Nicole has got a plexiform tumour, as she says. It's a very large tumour in her sciatic nerve. And that was giving her a lot of pain. And they would just kept dismissing it. So we went to the Marsden, we went everywhere. And in the end, we found the surgeon at Oxford. And he was the only one who would operate. So it was literally luck, just keep pushing to see different people all the time and just keep going. Don't give up.
Which
on top of looking after a child with a complex condition, and I had a younger daughter, which is very difficult when you've got a child with no complications who then gets jealous of the one with the complications. And you've got to deal with all of that on top of it. But it was literally just keep fighting. There was nothing easy.
No, it sounds it. And Nicole, I know the plastic surgeon has been very supportive, but also psychological support has really made a difference. Would you mind just describing how that has helped?
Yeah, so I've probably been seeing any type of like psychological support now for like 10 years, so it's quite a long time, but it help it really does help me. It's I think when I first started, I was that's when I was growing from like a young child to like a teenager, and like I said earlier, it's that is quite a difficult time for anyone, that transitioning just going into teenagehood. And then with the medical issues, it just made it harder. And it was nice to talk to someone who had a good understanding of the medical world. And it was like a safe space. Like it's someone I could talk to who didn't have any connections with them personally, but they just understood. And it really helped me to be able to get through my like physical pain with my tumor, but also to get through like the te being a teenager, just go through that because it is hard. I would say I think being a teenager in today's day and age is quite hard, and it's just helped with that. That was a better like kind of transitioning, I would say. Oh, nice.
Could I just,
Go
sorry.
on, Vanessa.
I have to say the Evelina for transition was amazing. So Nicole should have stayed there 16 and then moved on. They kept her till she was 19. So she had psychology there and that just carried on through. That made a huge difference. They are really good there, but I think it's down to individual hospitals rather than national. Evelina were excellent.
Thank you. And thank you both. So that's obviously quite difficult story to tell and relive. So really appreciate your openness to share that. Just going to bring in a couple of other people in the audience now. I just wonder if Tom is there, Tom Smith. Now, Tom is a trustee of
I am
mine.
indeed.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing? So yeah,
All
Tom's a
good.
trustee of mine and also lives with CF. And like a lot of CF patients, had a bumpy ride through adolescence. And I just wanted to bring you in now, Tom, really, to talk about, the importance of psychological support for you as well during that period.
It can't. I don't think it can be overstated. Good morning, everyone, by the way. My own transition to the adult clinic was delayed. So I have a there's a lot of similarities in my story with Nicole and Vanessa's, but there's some differences as well. I think with CF they have, I think there's up to around 10,000 patients in the UK with CF, and the transition from pediatrics to adults is, it's common, obviously not as common as it used to be, but because outcomes are improving, they're getting better. I'm 32 now, and I transitioned across when I was 16 or 17, I think. So apparently it's supposed to happen at about 14 or 15. But yeah, I think at that age, I was fine because basically my neglect and my denial had not caught up with me at that point. But I started, things went south for me really when I was about 18, 17 or 18. And I think around that age, I had my first lung transplant assessment. I think I've had two or three now. I still haven't had one because I've pulled my finger out basically. But apart, I imagine it's the same thing now, but back then at least there was a kind of a psychological evaluation as part of that lung transplant assessments process because it needs to kind of assess your support network, your resilience, because apparently you need to sort of deal with things like survivor's guilt and stuff like that. But for me, because I still see my therapist now, I started when I was 17 or 18. I see him every 3 or 4 weeks, and I think everybody should do it, regardless of CF, organ transplantation, any kind of trauma. I just think, the prevailing winds of the modern world are so damaging. and toxic that I think you need help to just sort of stay level in yeah. modern world. But for me, it's just, like I said at the beginning, it cannot be overstated how important. So yeah, it can't be overstated. And yeah, like I say, CF, no CF, healthy or otherwise, I think everybody should do it. And actually, I found that it's just given me a way to look at the world, a way to sort of process my own situation, my own diagnosis, my own prognosis, and how to deal with, you know, things that are have come my way and potentially will come my way. And also, my therapist is based in Leeds. He's called Gary Latchford, and he's just fantastic. And, you know, I work for a research ethics committee, and I do other interesting things, which I would never have heard about if it wasn't for him. So actually, after all these years, he's kind of, I suppose, gone from dealing, helping me deal with kind of acute and pressing trauma to now actually it's a bit more relaxed and it's more like touching base and giving me ideas and stuff. And yeah, from a professional point of view, it's been fantastic as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Tom. Going to bring in Samira now as our clinical psychologist. And Samira still works a day a week in the NHS as well. I just wanted to get your take on experience of supporting adolescent patients and what you think resonates with you in terms of the stories we've already heard, and then what types of psychological support you think could help.
Absolutely. Good morning, everyone. And thank you so much, Nicola and Thomas, for sharing your story. And it's interesting, Tom, when you talked about your therapy turning more into coaching, and it sounds like that transition has been fantastic. So I work one day a week in the pain management clinic, and the patients that I see, a lot of them have come in for medical reasons, but actually listening to you both, it's so similar in terms of there are other factors which obviously influence, and it's not only the condition itself, it's also being a, you know, an adolescent, being a teenager, and trying to, you know, figure out where they are and where that person is in this society and the world, and the societal pressures. So a lot of the people that I see, the focus is very much on the, you know, managing the emotions and managing the factors which influence that, and how that then impacts their condition, and not vice versa. So it's always starting from surface level and working our way down. And particularly in that transitional period with adolescents, you know, trying to manage the, finding that resilience, finding that confidence and that self-esteem, really working on, you know, being able to express themselves. And I felt, I see a lot that just talking about emotions and starting from the basics is something that a lot of us don't do, and we're never told how to do it as growing up. So really, you know, stripping everything down and starting from the basics is very much where I would go with when I speak to patients. And just, you know, education is so important. And sometimes we always, a lot of psychologists or people might think that therapy is about giving the answers, but it's not actually. It's working together with the individual and facilitating a you know, structured discussion around how they can find their inner ability to work through things, because ultimately you want them to be the person to be able to make those decisions. And so you know, there's, I could probably talk for an hour about different ways to support, but I think if anything, one thing I would say is that start from the basics, and you know, there are no assumptions, and particularly when it comes to children, giving them a space and a place to just express themselves and understand what their agenda is, instead of going in with an agenda, particularly from a therapeutic perspective. But yeah, that's what I wanted to add to that.
Thanks, Samira. Thank you. I've had a comment from another team member, and I just wanted to bring them in if they would like. It's really around the challenge of moving from parent-directed care to self-managed care, and the obvious challenges that raises. How is that for you? Let's start with you, Vanessa, and then we'll come to Nicole.
Sorry, what?
So moving from, so you know, as a parent of a child, you will direct sort of care and support, and then adolescence is that period where it converts into adolescents taking control of their care.
Yeah, It's very hard to let go. It's like today, Nicole's got an appointment with a plastic surgeon this afternoon, and I've categorically been told I'm not going. I mean, I'm really pleased with it, but, you know, and it's very easy as a parent to take over because you think you're doing the right thing. But you've got to give them the option to do stuff on their own. And this Nicole's doing more and more on her own. But this is the first time, because the surgeon she's seeing today is the one that's really changed her life. I feel I have to be there, but I don't. There's no reason for me to be there at all. And, you know, this is good. This is Nicole growing up. The one thing I just want to say is when I was fighting for Nicole to get better care and they offered psychology, which was, 10 years ago, my initial reaction was I hit the roof. I was so angry. I thought, well, what's psychology going to do? I don't want her to have psychology. I want her to have an operation. I want her to get better. I don't want psychology. And I calmed down and I thought, well, she might as well go. And it was the best thing I can say. The plastic surgeon and the psychologist, out of 40 or 50 medical professionals she's seen, they are the two that have really changed her life. And as she says, she still sees psychology. It helped her to learn to live with it. But at that time, I was actually livid that they were offering this as help, you know. And now I feel really embarrassed, because that's the big thing that I'm fighting for our kids within the charity. I just wanted to say that. And I think sometimes the stigma is going, but I think, you know, 10 years ago, it was like, she's not mad. It's not in her head. So I just wanted to say that. But
No, thanks, Vanessa. Thanks, Vanessa. I'm going to come to Nicole and Tom to talk about that switch from parental directed care to self-care. But before I do that, I can see Richard up there, so I'm going to bring Richard in. And Richard, can you just share some of your experiences of support that benefits adolescent patients in that sort of transition?
Yeah, and Gavin, thank you. I mean, I do think it's probably one of the biggest challenges in you know, allowing adolescents to grow and to make the decisions and start to make some of the mistakes that they want to, and for parents to let go of that kind of that blanket and that cotton wool that they've wrapped around them for very good reasons. So I think that I think it's one of the biggest challenges, and it's why there are often so many kind of complications as you move to adolescence. I do think this ability of patients to stay with the same group of clinicians that they've worked through from kind of 16 to 19 is a massive benefit. And Vanessa, you described that, and I think that's really important, because I think they're going through enough change during their adolescence as it is. So to have that continuity of care is really, really important. But it's then how you almost coach both sides, because you've got to have this kind of elasticity around decision making, where, as Vanessa described, you know, you really want to be there and you want to be involved and part of the decision-making process, but you know that the right thing to do is to let go at the same time. So I think there's that tension that you have to kind of lean into a bit and enable people to grow. And I think it's a critically important time. So the only other comment I wanted to make, Vanessa, you described it as lucky that you ended up with a clinician that worked. And I think it's actually kind of huge amounts of perseverance that you described is how you got lucky. You know, you didn't just accept what you were given. You challenged it, you pushed, and you pushed the boundaries. And I think that's the reason for the luck is the effort that you put in. Those are my thoughts, Gavin.
Thanks, Richard. Much appreciated. Back to Nicole then, and your side of the story in terms of that independence of care, and obviously a step in that is your consultation this afternoon with your plastic surgeon. Can you describe how you would like your mum to support you now, Nicole? I think that would be a good place to start this topic.
It's quite difficult. I think what she does now is good. Like she's there. Like I'll tell her what's happening. So is that I remember the first time I went to my first appointment on my own with psychology. That was my first appointment I ever traveled to London by myself, which in itself is quite a big thing because it's quite a long way to go for appointment, 2 hours when I was living back home. And then when I moved to uni, I think that's when I started doing a lot more things by myself, and it was be constantly just having to, for me, it was communication with my mum, so telling her what's going on, what's happening, that, and it's what she does now is good. It's just like, it'd be, if I ended up in an A&E, it would be the phone call of, yeah, I'm fine. And she's just, and every time now it's just like, okay, and it's normal, it's our now normal, and I just would be phoning her up and be like, I've got an appointment, I've got a scan, and it's just, can you just let me know how it goes, that kind of thing. Just, she still lets me be like, do it all by myself, but still just wants like check up, I think, like any parent just wants to make sure it all goes well.
Yeah. And were there times where you felt you were railing against your mum's support because it was too much? How did you move away from that sort of mindset?
I think it was me who, I think I remember going, I want to go by myself. It was it was my decision, which I quite liked. It wasn't my mum going, I think you can go by yourself. It was me going, oh, I don't need you. And yeah, that I quite liked. I think it's me, it's the, because it is me, it's my life, it's my condition, it's yeah, who I am, it's yeah, my condition, and it was better than, like, I think like I've had, I could say, like, say on my dad's side, it was more a different way, like, oh, you're old enough now, you should be able to do stuff by yourself.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just, don't think however old you get, you still just need that support when you go to places.
Yeah.
And that's what I quite liked from my mum, letting it be my decision to do things.
Yeah. And Tom, how about for you? I was thinking about the big issue just then, just thinking about note to, you know, the letter to your younger self. I wonder, Tom, what your letter would say to your younger self.
Oh, God. I think there'd be a few expletives in there. I honestly have no idea, but I think I would definitely like to... sorry, we've got a six-month-old dog next door. I think I would like to, in as un-narcissistic a way as possible, I would like to email myself a photo from today to when I was, maybe 15 or 16. Because the fact in my own story, my medication is my routine, my regime, my maintenance treatment is more or less exactly the same. And the only thing that's changed is my acceptance of my situation and the work that I put into it. And I think there's something a bit important about that. And going back to Nicole and Vanessa's story, I don't know how it works with youth tumors. I don't know anything about it, but in CF, what was really important about me taking control and responsibility of my situation is the really slowly subtle transfer of ownership from my parents to me. And I think I think that was probably led by me as well. But actually, the most important thing that has changed my life, really. Because I don't know how or how I didn't understand it in the first place ever, but the quality of my life depends on me and the effort that I put into my condition and work opportunities and relationships and everything like that. And it's the same thing. But I think... I would like to just revisit the what Vanessa said about her kind of shame about, you know, rejecting kind of emotional support and stuff like this. I think my parents are still not convinced of the benefit of me doing it, even though, they know exactly what I get through my professional life and how rich my life is because of it and this, that and the other. But also I think that, don't tell them this, but I think they need to speak to somebody about my situation. Maybe less so now because my life is much more level. I'm in much more control. But I think back in 1988, I'd be extremely surprised if there was any kind of emotional support for parents, let alone, you know, obviously young patients and stuff. But I think, even though I've had a massively positive experience from emotional support, I think that especially when I was sick, because it was a period of my life for about 7 years where I was in and out of hospital, they would have, between us, they would have benefited massively from doing it, massively. Mm-hmm. It's a hard sell, but I just wish it could have been forced upon them, you know?
Thanks, Tom. And Samira, that support, psychological support for parents and caregivers, do you want to just, and then I'll come to Vanessa and get your thoughts on that as well.
Absolutely. And the reason why I was smiling when both of you, Vanessa and Tommy, mentioned it was because I still have patients who come to me as adults and say, I don't know why my consultants referred me to psychology. Is my pain all in my head or is my condition not there? And there's that explanation still needed. So I think very much that stigma, although it's starting to reduce, I think people's mindset when it affects them personally is still there. So, you know, that whole aspect on trying to understand how psychology can support, I've got this condition, but you know, what difference will it make? So there's lots of a need to really go through that in detail. But I think moving on, particularly when I talk about, when I mentioned, you know, being that the individual is an individual, but actually their environment around them, so particularly their family, their friends, siblings, whether it's their partner, there's definitely a need for supporting them, bringing them into this therapeutic sessions and giving them a space to really understand how it is in a safe environment where they can really express themselves together and work through those maybe some, you know, disagreements or communication. I think definitely I always suggest and recommend that, you know, bringing in people who are living with you are also affected as much as the individual as well. So giving them a space to talk is so important, whether that's separate therapeutic sessions or together. But I'm definitely an advocate for that and would suggest that should always be factored in when looking at it from a family perspective as well.
Thanks, Samira. Vanessa, any further thoughts from you on this topic? I know talking earlier, this session has raked up some difficult memories for you. So, what's your view on the need for psychological support beyond the adolescent?
Oh, it's just absolutely needed. I mean, Nicole's carrying everything; she's stronger because of it. But it's finding the right person. Nicole was extremely lucky. She found the right person. She's always had the right person. But I know other people that have gone for psychological help and it's done nothing because they just haven't made that link with someone. So it's getting the right person that's important. And the family, definitely. I mean, I know Nicole won't mind me saying, but her dad almost dismissed that she had a condition. And it was constantly just get on with it. He didn't accept the fact that she had a wheelchair, even to the fact that he wouldn't let her use it. So in the end, she just stopped going to see him and going out for the day because he made her feel so bad about using a wheelchair. And he needed help just to come to terms with it. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky because Evelina have got the most incredible psychological department that... when Nicole was having her psychological sessions, sometimes somebody would come along and just come and take me for coffee and just talk casually, and that helped me so much. You know, they are different. I don't know, not everywhere's like that, but everyone could take a leaf out of Evelina.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear, and that I imagine is why you're pushing so hard. For your charity to support families and patients.
Yeah, it's needed. There's no question. You know, with or without a condition, it's needed. But it's even more so when you're struggling on top of everything else.
Yeah. Okay, Nicola, I think we're going to come to you. As I said, you're on the cusp. You're about to enter this phase with your son. What are your hopes and fears for this period?
Yeah, so my son is nine, and I think actually something that you've all touched on there, which is really important, is this idea of emotional support for the parents in the transition period. So, you know, many parents, obviously, possibly from birth, have had quite literally their child's life hanging in the balance, and the decisions they made have been so paramount. And to guide the child through that in an emotional support way is really important, but actually teaching us how to learn to let go, because I think that's the fear, isn't it? I mean, it literally stops my heart thinking about there's going to be that point when he's going to say, I don't need you, I've got this, you know, and then you're going to be thinking, has he got it? Is he, you know, is he going to make the right decisions? Obviously, we've taken them so far, and it's been all consuming, and we've had to make so many difficult decisions. And I think that actually part of the transition should be getting mum and dad ready to let go in a controlled way, so that there isn't any battle, so there isn't any feeling of like, oh, we're left at home now, and there's no guilt around it. I think that really should be embedded in part of that process, because otherwise, you know, like everything with parenting, you're doing it for the first time, you're in new territory, and it's a really scary prospect. And I think the other thing that's really important for me is the level of information we give children through the different phases. I find that really difficult to know what to tell my child at what stage of his life. And I've had things in the past where people said, oh, you give them too much information, but then other people say, oh, you know, they need to know more. And I think that's really difficult to know what is appropriate for a child when they have something that is a degenerative condition. How do you introduce those themes and at what stage so that they understand it, but without putting fear and anxiety in when it doesn't need to be? So those are things I think are really important. I'd like to see more of that happen in terms of educating the parents, you know, not just looking at the child, but how do the parents go through those key phases and know when to give the right information? How do they learn to let go? How do they support the child? Like Vanessa's done an amazing job with Nicole, that she was confident to be able to say, I don't need you, you can stand down now. You know, how do you allow that to happen really smoothly? And that, yeah, absolutely. Just so to echo everything they've said, really. But yeah, it's ahead of me. So it's really interesting and inspiring listening to Nicole and Tom's, you know, to see how they've done that. But it's a fear of, will they make the right decisions? Have I got them this far and I'm going to see things deteriorate because they haven't? And just that balance, really, isn't it? But I think educating the parents, we need to know how to get our children through that phase, not just clinically, but emotionally, and to understand the process.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point, Nicola, around guidance on when to share and what to share. I think the challenge is that kids mature at different ages and can take on different information at different ages. And I want to bring Samira back in now, just to talk a little bit about how we can individualize support. How can we better understand? Because I think we have the specific disease, we have the maturity and the openness of the child, we have the education of the parent. There's a lot of moving parts in knowing what to share and when. How can we better understand the journey the patient is on and the family, and then understand when to support and what support to give?
Good question. And it's also, I guess it varies and it depends. So, I mean, from how we would traditionally do it is trying to really understand that holistic journey, as Gavin mentioned, and trying to figure out where within that process, you know, where is it best to intervene or develop an intervention to best support the carer, the family member, or the child. And so it's being able to just look at it from an abstract perspective. And if we want to, you know, as we said, you know, we are all unique and we're all different, and we'll have different points where we will find that information helpful and useful, but others will be different. So some people will mature later, some people will want to take in information later. And, you know, as Nico mentioned, you know, there is no race, you know, we all progress at our own level and our own time. But if we want to get a populational viewpoint of a particular, you know, rare disease or a particular journey, it's important that, you know, we start to create that in an abstract way to be able to then see whether it's that transitional phase, whether it's before that transitional phase, whether it's after, maybe 6 months later, checking in with the child and the family of how that experience has gone for them, and what can be supported. I think it's a trial and error, you know, until we do it, we won't know. And different people, like as Vanessa mentioned, Evelyn Centre are doing quite a lot, and maybe that's a good template to start off with, but looking at it from that, so gathering that insight, being able to really articulate that in a way within that journey, and really starting to see how and best we can support you know, people from a populational perspective is so important. But then when you have that individual therapy or individual psychological support, that should be personalized to you as an individual. And so it's being able to do it from a top-down sort of approach, and really working that out. So I guess in short, I don't have the answer, but in summary, there is a process to be able to start to articulate what that could look like. But I think I completely agree. You know, it's the individual experience, but also it's looking at it from a you know, outwards perspective as well.
Yeah. I think another thing that's really important about that is, and Vanessa touched on this earlier, is actually the siblings' journey in this, because alongside this, you may have younger or older siblings who are also transitioning in terms of their level of understanding around their siblings' condition, and the impact it's had and is going to continue to have on their life. So as Samira mentioned about this holistic approach of the family, that's so important, because many rare diseases have a vast impact on siblings, and their ability to understand that changes greatly as well. So that support and transition actually almost happens to them as well.
Agree completely.
Thanks, Nicola. And yeah, that's really, really useful comments. And I've just been listing out what I've heard, I think, as ways that this transition period could improve. And maybe we can spend the last sort of 10 minutes on improvements. And I will come to Nicole and Vanessa to ask you in a minute around what would have made your experience a better one. So have a think about that for a minute. I'm just going to list out what I've taken as ways that this support could be improved. And continuity of care was one key message. Psychological support has come through very, very strongly. Supported independence so ensuring that the adolescent can take responsibility for their own self-care. Accept that support around acceptance, and again that links back to psychological support. Not forgetting the caregiver and supporting them and the wider family. Controlled information sharing at the appropriate point, and flexibility of approach within some sort of template would help that information sharing. And the last one I've got is a holistic approach to this, so looking at this as a family unit and ensuring siblings are considered as well as part of that. And Vanessa, maybe you could add in, or and Nicole, around how Nicole's sibling has coped through all this as well. But Nicole, on that question, what do you think could have been improved to make your experience a better one?
I think it was probably trying to get other family members maybe involved, because I remember my mum will probably agree with me. I was trying to go, like, is it family sessions as well? And my dad was very against it, and my sister didn't go because my dad was against it. So it made me feel quite not like I wanted to be centered, but not important, like my issues weren't important. And then I know still to this day I've got family members that struggle, and I think it would be helpful if, like, psychology was also branched out to, like, the other members, like, including grandparents, because my mum will agree, my nan just goes, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, like, she just always goes, it's fine,
it's French. Okay, that was an accent, French. I have to
sorry
say.
it's a wholesome habit, whenever I talk about my nan and when she does things, I put her accent on. She's very much like, it's okay, and it's kind of doesn't want to think about it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not much as the impact on me as such as my nan, but more of an impact on my mum, because mm-hmm. it's my mum's mum who doesn't seem to be grasping the realities of having a granddaughter or a daughter with a chronic illness.
Yeah.
Because I was constantly told from diagnosis, it was like, well, she's going to be all right. She's going to be fine. It's going to be all right. And I know people say that because that's what they want to believe. But I just wanted someone to say, you know, we're just going to help you through this. Whatever happens, we're going to help you. But it wasn't. It was just like, she'll be fine. She'll be fine. Oh, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong. And they have no idea, even to this day, what it's all about. And her dad even said to Nicole's sister, your mum just wants to see her in a wheelchair. And so Nicole's sister, she's better now. She's 21. She understands Nicole, but it puts such a strain. Mm. And to the fact that my daughter, she went to live with her dad because the pressure was me taking Nicole to hospital, me doing everything with Nicole. You know, we'd have 3 appointments a week up in London. So I lost my daughter through it. I mean, she's back fine now, but I did lose her. But the other thing is, I don't think he would have gone anyway. I don't know how you get round the people that just don't want to go and don't want to know. So there'll always be that. But I think it should be there. I needed it. I needed a lot more support than I got. And everything changed when Nicole got the support from the Evelina.
Yeah. Well, you know, to both of you, I just so appreciate your openness to talk about experiences, because it does help us learn and provide better support at this challenging time. So really, really do appreciate your honesty here around experiences.
Sorry, I don't know if it's anything, but also I think, I don't know if Samir has noticed it, but I know a lot of people with conditions who have the same condition as me but aren't as badly as affected, they get guilty that they're taking up psychological support. And I try to remind them that they're still worth, you know, they are not worth, what's the word, issues are still, they're still worth it, you know, they are still allowed to have those same feelings and thoughts. I think trying to encourage those who aren't as ill that their support, psychological support, is still fine that they're not taking up resources.
Absolutely. Samir, any thoughts on those comments?
I wanted to just add 2 thoughts on what you were saying. One, I completely agree. I do see that, but I see it a lot in teenagers and younger adults who will come in and say that they are not sure if they are taking up resource more than adults, you know, in their 30s or late 20s. So I definitely see that it is that age set where they are feeling quite guilty of receiving support. So it's the need to really say, you know, you are here. I had a patient that I saw recently, who was 18, and she had similar, she wasn't able to declare that to me for a good few sessions, where she felt guilty coming to see me because she felt somebody who was, might have wanted it more and needed it more. And so it's trying to work through that, and it's so important that we work through that to maximise the support that they have. The other thought I wanted to mention was that the terminology where Vanessa used, that it's okay, because when I see a lot of adults who have gone through that whole transition and gone through life to a point where they've now accessed psychological support, and for them the biggest thing was their early experiences of invite people around them who almost embedded it within them that it's okay mentality, and that you need to get on with things. So for them, they started to neglect their health medical needs because they wanted to just be this normalized persona that they had or other people had of them. So they got to a point where they wanted to be, they were you know, upset that they hadn't now got a job or, you know, gone for university and because of you know, not reaching that target that other people had placed for them. So I think that it's okay mentality, it does catch up to a lot of these individuals when they're in their adulthood, and so that there's then in that sense there's a higher psychological need then to work through, and lots of things that they need to work through which they had experienced. So I agree, you know, when I think Nicole has been so lucky that she had you as that supportive factor, when people were saying that it's fine, you know, you're still there grounding her and supporting her and showing that you're you know, you're there for her. And it's so important that that message is prolonged. So yeah, so I just wanted to add that in.
Thanks, Amira. Great stuff. We are coming towards the end of this session. Again, I just want to thank Vanessa and Nicole for being really, really open and honest with this very challenging journey they've been on, and the support you clearly offer each other in getting through this. I think loud and clear is the need for psychological support, and not just for the adolescent, but the family, the wider family. And you know, I think in these times of COVID, psychological services are being stretched significantly already. And I do think there's a message here for pharma companies out there that if you're considering deploying or providing patient support, that you consider psychological support as part of that engagement program, and you know that support is offered beyond just the patient. So I think there is a role here for industry to step up and offer more supportive services for patients living with rare diseases, and particularly during that adolescent period. So I just wanted to thank everyone. I also want to thank Tom and Nicola and Samira and Richard for your comments as well. I want to thank the audience for listening to this. I think it's a really important topic. Like I said, we're keen to keep this alive. We will, with the help of Nicola and team, get this written up, and it will be published in the next Rare Revolution. So I hope you take a read of that once it's completed and published early next year. But thanks again, Nicole. Thanks, Vanessa. Really, really appreciate your discussion and your thoughts today. And thanks again. And everyone, enjoy the rest of the Congress. Thank you.